From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
Remember when Donald Trump said that as president, he could declassify documents just by thinking about it?
If you're the president of the United States, you can declassify just by saying it's declassified, even by thinking about it, because you're sending it to Mar-a-Lago or to wherever you're sending it. And there doesn't have to be a process. There can be a process, but there doesn't have to be. You're the president. You make that decision. So when you send it, it's declassified.
Well, the federal judge handling the criminal classified documents case against the former president seems to be buying into that unsupported theory that Trump's possession of highly classified materials was covered by the Presidential Records Act. And special counsel Jack Smith has vented his frustration with Judge Eileen Cannon, taking the Trump appointee to task for her request for jury instructions on the matter, and threatening to go to the 11th Circuit, which has already reversed Cannon twice. Joining me is former federal prosecutor Robert Mintz, a partner at Carter & English. Bob, a ruling by Judge Cannon seems to have moved the ball forward, but before we get to that, we need some background. Will you explain why the special counsel is so incensed, I think it's fair to say, with Judge Cannon considering what I think is one of the most off-the-wall claims by Trump, that he transformed national security documents into his own personal property under the Presidential Records Act?
So what has prosecutors so incensed here is that the judge is fixating on the Presidential Records Act, which is, according to prosecutors, a law that has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with this case. And what they're concerned about is that if the judge gives an instruction about the Presidential Records Act to a jury, it's essentially nudging them potentially towards an acquittal or possibly even leaving the door open for the judge herself to acquit the former president at the end of the proceeding by declaring that the government had failed to prove its case.
So in this scathing response, the special counsel called this Trump theory pure fiction and flatly said several times that the judge's legal reasoning is just wrong, asking her to rule quickly so that he can appeal to the 11th Circuit if she rules against him.
Well, what prosecutors have done is essentially argued that this is a last-minute argument and that there's no factual basis in the record whatsoever to even support a claim that these records were protected by the Presidential Records Act. The Presidential Records Act was enacted post-Watergate to clarify what records belong to the president and what records belong to the public. And the Presidential Records Act makes very clear that only purely personal records, records relating to the president's personal activities, health records, family records, those types of personal records, those could be removed. But any records relating to the public, such as national security, national policy, anything related to the function of the president acting as president, those records belong to the White House and were not permitted to be removed under the Presidential Records Act. What the defense here is trying to argue is that former President Trump transformed those records, which are clearly public in nature, into personal records merely by removing them and taking them to Mar-a-Lago. They're not even suggesting that at any point in time former President Trump had designated them as personal under the Presidential Records Act. And prosecutors pointed to the fact that they interviewed all of the people who were involved in those records in the White House at the time, and none of them recall any reference to those records being related to the Presidential Records Act. So the defense argument goes, that simply because they were removed and brought to Mar-a-Lago, they were transformed into personal records. That's something that the prosecution thinks is absurd on its face. And even injecting that question into the trial and getting it in front of the jury would be highly prejudicial to prosecutors.
Jack Smith just seems to be at the end of his rope with Judge Cannon.
Yeah, prosecutors are taking a very aggressive approach with the judge here, but I think in their minds they have no choice because the judge has yet to make a decision on so many important motions that are still pending before her, and those could affect the trial going forward.
The special counsel also gave the judge a little nudge, saying, oh, and you should rule on Trump's motion to dismiss the case based on the Presidential Records Act. And lo and behold, 2 days later, she ruled on that motion, which has been sitting on her desk since February, denying Trump's motion to dismiss, but leaving the door open.
So what the Trump defense team had asked the judge to do was to throw out the indictment altogether based upon the Presidential Records Act. This ruling is very limited. What it does is it says there will be a trial. It says, at least as far as the Presidential Records Act goes, that is not a basis to dismiss this indictment. But she does leave open the door to dealing with this issue at some point later down the road. She simply says the Presidential Records Act is not a basis to dismiss this indictment pre-trial, but it leaves the possibility that the defense will raise this issue at some point during the trial. And this whole question about whether the jury will be instructed on the Presidential Records Act and whether or not it has any relevance whatsoever to the trial has been left open to be decided on another day.
Judge Cannon called the special counsel's request, or really demand, for the issue to be resolved before trial unprecedented and unjust. Is it unprecedented for a prosecutor to want to know before trial whether a judge is going to allow a defendant to pursue a wild theory at trial?
Well, what Jack Smith's trying to do is to smoke the judge out on this issue and get a decision one way or the other, because what prosecutors don't want to have happen is that the jury gets impaneled, the trial begins, and then this issue is decided. Because at that point, once the jury is impaneled, double jeopardy attaches, and prosecutors will not be able to appeal that decision if ultimately Judge Cannon decides that the Presidential Records Act is a viable defense. Prosecutors know that that would be the death knell for their case, because it would essentially tell jurors that simply designating records as personal is enough to avoid the Espionage Act, and it would entirely gut the prosecution. So prosecutors are trying to get the judge to go on record one way or the other on this issue, and all she's done so far is to say it is not something that will prevent this trial from going forward, but she's leaving the possibility that the Presidential Records Act will still be an issue down the road, and that's something that is going to have prosecutors very concerned.
The special counsel can't appeal this decision because he won it, but is it time for him to take the nuclear option, so to speak? It's not only this decision of Cannon's, but others that have confounded legal experts. She's moving so slowly, and the motions that she hasn't decided are piling up. And there seems to be no method to her madness, if you will. She hasn't even set a trial date, yet she's requesting jury instructions. Is it time for the special counsel to take that drastic step and ask the 11th Circuit to remove Judge Cannon from the case?
Well, I think prosecutors are going back to the war room right now and trying to decide how to respond to this decision, because they got a ruling, but they didn't get the ruling they want because it's only preliminary and it doesn't really ultimately decide the question of Presidential Records Act and whether or not it will be a part of this trial. And I think prosecutors have to come up with a way to try to bring this issue to the Court of Appeals if they can, or to force the judge to make that decision at some point prior to the trial. As long as she makes the decision before the jury is impaneled, that gives prosecutors the opportunity to immediately appeal that case up to the 11th Circuit. That still, however, does raise the prospect, if she waits until just prior to trial to address this issue, that the trial will be delayed, and then that could push the trial back after November. So prosecutors are dealing not only with trying to get this decision clarified, but they also want to get the decision clarified as soon as possible so so that they don't have an appellate delay that ultimately pushes the trial after November.
Let's turn now to the hush money case in Manhattan, which now appears like it will be Trump's first criminal trial, despite the fact that he's tried to get it delayed 8 times. And on Wednesday, Judge Juan Merchan rejected Trump's motion to postpone the trial until after the Supreme Court determines whether Trump has immunity from prosecution in a separate criminal trial.
What we're seeing here is a motion by the Trump defense team to try to delay the trial for yet another reason, arguing that it ought to be delayed until a decision is made by the Supreme Court in connection with the January 6th insurrection case, which has to do with a question of presidential immunity. What the judge in the New York case decided was that that issue could have been raised a long time ago, and to raise it now, only days before the trial, is simply too late, and so he rejected that out of hand.
Trump is also asking to delay the trial due to pretrial publicity, which the Manhattan DA points out is of his own making. Also, pretrial publicity, isn't that something that judges normally say we can handle that in the voir dire?
Yeah. Whenever you have a high-profile case involving a high-profile defendant, and certainly this case fits the bill in every respect in that regard, you always have jurors who have read about the case, who have formed an opinion about the defendant, who may have prejudged the case. That's going to happen in every high-profile case where all of the pretrial proceedings and all of the charges have been in the media for months, perhaps even years. And so the voir dire process, which is the opportunity for lawyers for both the defense and the prosecution to screen out jurors, because in order to sit on that jury, a juror has to say that they have not formed any opinion as to the guilt or innocence of the defendant, that they will be able to make a decision based solely upon the evidence that's presented during the trial. And that process may take some time, given the high degree of publicity that has predated this trial, but eventually they will find a set of jurors who meet that criteria.
As they always do. Thanks so much, Bob. That's Robert Mintz of McCarter and English. And in Georgia on Thursday, Trump lost another motion to dismiss charges against him when Judge Scott McAfee rejected his argument that his efforts to overturn the 2020 election were protected by the First Amendment. Coming up next, who will pay for the Baltimore Bridge collapse? I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Divers, welders, engineers, and salvage crews are working around the clock to clear the wreckage of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore that collapsed when a massive container ship crashed into it last Tuesday. Maryland Governor Wes Moore says it's an extremely dangerous and painstaking task as crews have to cut through the mangled steel piece by piece before cranes can lift them out of the water.
We're talking about water that is so murky and so filled with debris that divers cannot see any more than a foot or two in front of them. We're talking about a situation where a portion of the bridge beneath the water has been described by Unified Command as chaotic wreckage.
Industry experts predict the damages could reach $4 billion. But the owner of the ship filed a petition in Maryland federal court on Monday seeking to limit its legal liability to about $43.7 million, invoking a 19th century law once used by the owners of the Titanic. Joining me is maritime law expert Martin Davies, the director of Tulane University's Maritime Law Center. The owner and the operator of the ship filed a petition saying the collapse of the bridge was not due to any fault of theirs. But even if they're found liable, it shouldn't be for more than the current value of the ship and cargo. Tell us about that petition.
The law in question dates from 1851. There are international equivalents based on international conventions. So limitation of liability is a very typical thing that occurs in the wake of any maritime casualty. And what the law allows is for a ship owner to petition to limit its total liability for any claims arising out of a single incident to the value of the vessel at the end of the voyage, plus any pending freight, any sums owed to it for carriage of cargo or passengers. The other main advantage of limitation proceedings is that it enables the ship owner to litigate the case in a single forum, in a single court of its own choosing. Because what happens is that once the ship owner has petitioned the federal court for limitation of liability, it must pay into court or give security for the amount of the value of the vessel at the end of the voyage. And then once that fund has been constituted, and it will be constituted by the ship's liability insurer, the P&I Club. But once the fund has been constituted, the federal court will then issue an order saying that no claimant can bring a claim in any other court except that federal court. So, for example, the claimants could not bring a claim in Maryland State Court or New York State Court or California State Court, anywhere. All claims must be brought against the fund that has been constituted in the court. So the two main advantages from the ship owner's point of view is, one, it has at least a chance of limiting its liability. But secondly, it can marshal all the claims into one place, the court of its own choosing, which in this case is the Federal District Court in Maryland.
I take it the judge is going to decide whether or not to limit liability. So what happens? Is it the plaintiffs who have to come up with reasons why the liability should not be limited?
It's a little confusing in terms of terminology because the plaintiff is the ship owner, and the ship owner must show that it was not guilty of what is called privity or knowledge. That's the expression in the statute, because it's only entitled to limit its liability if it itself, the ship owner, was not at fault. And it does have the burden of showing that it was not at fault. But it's the plaintiff, so the liability claimants, which in this case will be the families of those who died, the personal injury claimants, and also the cost of the bridge, they are not actually the plaintiff in this limitation proceeding. The procedure feels a little bit upside down or back to front or whatever, because the ship owner must show that it was not guilty of fault or privity.
How does mechanical failure fit in?
Yes, mechanical failure will be a significant issue in this case, I think, because if the incident had occurred because of a pure sailing mistake on the part of those navigating the vessel, then the ship owner probably would be entitled to limit its liability. That was the example that everybody has been talking about in relation to the Titanic. The Titanic was a perfectly seaworthy, brand new vessel, sank because of sailing errors. There, the ship owner was held to be able to limit its liability. But if the incident occurred because of some defect in the vessel, that looks much more like it might be the responsibility of the ship owner itself. It has to be personal fault of the ship owner or manager. And, well, it's too early to say, but there clearly seem to have been some physical problems with the vessel itself, which I think will be front and center in the limitation proceeding.
What physical problems have you heard about?
Well, the engine, the power failed more than once, I believe, before the vessel struck the bridge. And also questions have been raised about the quality of the fuel that's been used. Most of that, I must say, is speculation because none of that has been recorded yet. But if the ship's power failed, which it seems clearly that it did, that's going to raise questions of whether the ship owner is responsible for the condition of the vessel that caused the power to fail.
So this law has been used in the most notable maritime disasters. How often has it worked? Does it work more often than not?
No, it fails more often than not. The statistics show that the ship owner's petition to limit its liability succeeds in only about 32% of the cases. So it fails most of the time under U.S. law, as in, you know, 68% of the time it fails. But that doesn't stop ship owners from petitioning in the event of a casualty, because the other benefit of the limitation proceedings, as I've said, is to bring all the claims together in one place so that the ship owner then doesn't have to fight lots of different lawsuits about the same incident in different jurisdictions.
Within hours of the bridge's collapse, President Biden said that the federal government will pay for the entire cost of rebuilding the bridge. Is that something the federal government should be paying for, or should the insurance be paying for that?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I believe that the bridge did carry an interstate highway, which would be a reason for the federal government participating, if you like, in the cost of the repairs. But what the maritime law says is that only those who have suffered physical damage to their property can claim against the vessel. So the question will be, like, who actually owned the bridge? And now, if it's the state of Maryland, then the state of Maryland is the proper claimant. And the federal government choosing to pay looks much more like an economic loss. And there's a Supreme Court decision that says that purely economic losses are not recoverable from the ship itself. So all of the economic losses that I'm sure are already being suffered in the city of Baltimore are not recoverable from the ship. And I think that will come as a surprise to people that they're not allowed to recover purely economic loss claims. But that rule is sometimes called the bright line rule because it's very clear cut, unlike many legal rules. If you've suffered physical damage to your property, you can recover economic losses from the ship. If you haven't, you can't.
How long does a claim like this take to play out?
Oh, gosh, years. It will be years to work out exactly what happened and the responsibility for it. Litigation of this complexity doesn't move very quickly. Plus, it's going to be a long time before it's even known how much it costs to replace the bridge. So, you know, the magnitude of the claim will not be clear for years, and litigation of this kind generally does not move very quickly.
Is there anyone besides the owner of the ship and the manager that can be sued here?
Well, there are lots of people that can be sued, but I don't think there's anybody other than the owner and manager that seem to be plausible candidates for litigation, because the charterer of the vessel, Maersk, is merely the commercial operator. It's not responsible for navigational operation. And whatever happened here seems to have been a navigational problem, not a commercial problem. There is a possibility, I think, that if the problem is with deficient fuel, then there might be the possibility of a cross-claim against Maersk, but the principal responsibility will lie with the ship owner.
So, insurance. The insurance is about
$3
billion?
$3.1 billion.
Thank you.
That's what it is, right?
So, will the insurance definitely cover this? Let's say it's found that they can't limit their legal liability. Does the insurance cover it, whether it's negligence or not?
Yes, most definitely. The insurers are what are called a P&I club, protection and indemnity club, and they are mutual self-insurance associations of ship owners. And they don't operate like commercial insurers. Their instinct is to pay because they are all ship owners. And so every ship owner that's a member of the club that has got a ship entered in the club is both an insurer and an assured. And so the coverage offered by P&I clubs is very comprehensive and has very few exceptions. It's not like a commercial insurer where there are all sorts of exclusions in the contract. And so the club will cover this, even if it turns out to be negligence on the part of the ship owner. It will definitely be covered by the club. And then what happens is the club, the particular club that Dali was entered in, is Britannia, which is one of 12 P&I clubs forming something called the International Group, which covers over 90% of the ships in the world. And they have this complicated pooling arrangement. If claims exceed a certain level, which they most certainly will in this case, the individual club no longer bears it itself. It's pooled among all the 12 clubs in the international group. They have commercial reinsurance, and it's a complicated scheme, but the total pool of insurance sitting behind the ship owner is at present $3.1 billion.
So there's no reason for plaintiffs to rush to file claims. There's enough there.
Well, no, because now that the ship owner has filed its limitation suit, they will have to file suit in those limitation proceedings. They'll have to bring claims against the limitation fund. What they will want to do is to try and argue that the ship owner itself was at fault and therefore it's not entitled to limit its liability, which then gives them access to this, you know, sort of huge ocean of insurance funds.
Many are saying that this could be the most expensive marine disaster in history. Is there anything to be learned from these?
Well, yes. I mean, it's a very unusual case, obviously. In some respects, not unique. I mean, ships have knocked down bridges before. What is so spectacular about this one is that the bridge completely fell down and needs to be completely replaced. So in terms of the amount of money at stake, yes, it will be more expensive than perhaps any other. But in other respects, the way that maritime casualties work is fairly clear and well settled. I mean, there's always a limitation suit. There's always the question of whether the ship owner was at fault. There's always the question of the extent to which the club will respond. I mean, it sounds glib, but we know how this works. And I don't think there's any new law likely to be made here.
It seems like such a specialized area of the law. Thanks so much for joining us. That's Martin Davies, director of Tulane University's Maritime Law Center. Coming up next, why South Carolina will be using a map declared unconstitutional for the 2024 elections. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Is this gerrymander based on politics, or is it a way to get to an ultimate goal, an ultimate political goal, but the gerrymandering is based on race? And what the two of them do is that they show that black Democrats are excluded from District 1 at a far greater percentage than white Democrats are.
That was Justice Elena Kagan back in October of last year when the Supreme Court heard oral arguments about South Carolina's map and whether Republicans were motivated by race or politics when they shifted 30,000 black voters out of the state's first district to ensure that Republicans would have a comfortable majority in that district represented by Nancy Mace. The justices were considering a three-judge panel's unanimous conclusion that the map was an unconstitutional racial gerrymander drawn with a discriminatory purpose. 6 months later, and the Supreme Court has yet to make its decision. So with time running out ahead of voting deadlines and the South Carolina legislature's failure to redraw the map as ordered, the three-judge panel has decided that the unconstitutional map will be used in the state's congressional elections this year. Joining me is elections law expert Richard Brafald, a professor at Columbia Law School. Rich, tell us about the long and winding legal road to this South Carolina map.
Following the 2020 census, the Republican legislature of South Carolina redistricted. They didn't need to change the number of seats, but they moved some around in order to improve the prospects for Republican. Actually, it's Congresswoman Nancy Mace, who represents District 1 near Charleston. And what they did is they basically made her district more Republican and an adjacent district more Democratic. In so doing, they moved a significant number of black voters from her district to the adjacent district, District 6. That led to a lawsuit that this was a form of racial gerrymandering, that the voters were being moved because of their race. That lawsuit was brought, and the plaintiffs won that case before a three-judge court in early 2023. The judge directed the legislature to redistrict. The legislature has been resisting that ever since and has taken appeals, and the case was actually argued before the Supreme Court in October, 6 months ago now. The Supreme Court has yet to rule on South Carolina's appeal. Many thought that that would be decided much earlier since they heard the case fairly early in the term. With the legislature not having redistricted and this case having been sitting in the Supreme Court now for quite some time, the three-judge court basically decided it's too late. The period for people filing to become candidates in the primary had already opened. In fact, I think it's already closed by now. There's soon going to be a deadline sometime in April for sending out military and overseas ballots. And the court basically said, although the ideal would be to go forward because they did hold the current lines unlawful going back to the start of 2023, they said, and given the fact that the litigation hasn't been resolved to the Supreme Court, the legislature hasn't done anything yet, it's too late for this year. So although we don't like it, we are going to allow the elections to go forward under the old rules that the court had said were unconstitutional as a racial gerrymander.
So the court said they're going to now use the maps that were declared unconstitutional. Is there anything else this court could have done to avoid that?
Well, I guess they could have appointed a special master and actually drawn the lines themselves. I think their feeling was, you know, we will know eventually from the Supreme Court whether these are good lines or not. And it is beginning to get close to the election. And I think the problem is the case began wending its way to the Supreme Court about a year ago. The court, I think, last spring set the case down for oral argument. They actually had that oral argument, as I said, 6 months ago. It's just taken a huge amount of time to move forward. And no one really quite understands why it's been delayed so long in the Supreme Court, especially since I think many observers felt that South Carolina actually did reasonably well in the oral argument. It was hard to tell whether the Supreme Court's going to affirm the lower court decision or not. But in any event, the state has effectively won, at least for this year. Even if the Supreme Court affirms the court, agrees that the lines are unconstitutional, those lines are going to be used for the 2024 election.
Both the state and the civil rights groups who were challenging the map had asked the Supreme Court to issue a decision by January 1st so they could prepare for the upcoming elections. Is this the first time or have there been other times when the Supreme Court has not been acting particularly fast and has allowed maps that have been declared unconstitutional to be used?
Well, I think that's what happened actually with the Alabama litigation where the Supreme Court stayed a lower court decision holding a plan violates the Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court stayed that, and then more than a year later finally actually decided the case and actually said that the lower court had been correct. And at that point, the map was changed. But in the meantime, an election had been held under the map, which the lower court had felt was illegal, but the Supreme Court had stayed for a considerable period of time so that they could decide the case. So that affected the 2022 election.
It just boggles the mind that in a case like this, they can't get a decision out. Although, I mean, the Supreme Court has been handing out decisions more slowly as of late.
This does seem to have been one of the slowest years. The people who keep track of this have said that they got off to the slowest start of any year in a very long time, and they've still issued relatively few opinions.
So we had the Alabama case where the court came out with a ruling that was favorable to the challengers. But yet, as you say, in the oral arguments in the South Carolina case, it seemed like it was going against the challengers. Explain the difference between the two cases.
The issue in this case really has more to do with how do you disentangle racial gerrymandering from partisan gerrymandering. Kind of the central issue in this case is the Republican legislature in South Carolina is happy to say that what they did was a partisan gerrymander, because given the Supreme Court's decision a few years ago, partisan gerrymandering cannot be challenged. It's non-justiciable. It's not unconstitutional, according to the Supreme Court, but racial gerrymandering is. And often the two are closely connected. If you're moving a big block of black voters who happen to be Democrats or Democratic voters who happen to be black, there is a debate as to what exactly the state is doing. The lower court here concluded that based on a variety of factors, it was better characterized as a racial gerrymander. The issue in Alabama was differently complicated in that there the state was using a basic configuration of how to draw districts in the state that they'd been using for some time. They made just minor changes from one census to the next, but was not a conscious or an obvious effort in the 2020 redistricting. But the plaintiffs were able to show that the districting structure that the state had been using for several decades discriminated against black voters because of the way the districts were drawn. And although you couldn't show that the state intended to do this, they were able to present alternative maps which were just as straightforward, you know, no more convoluted, no more, you know, odd shapes than the maps being used, which would provide fairer representation for black voters. So that case is very much about what does fair representation require for minority voters. And this case was really about whether or not the discrimination going on here was racial or partisan.
This ruling came a day after a different federal court upheld a congressional map in Florida that favors Republicans and erases a seat held by a black Democrat.
Again, I think it was a similar question of whether or not this was race or party, and they concluded it was party. And when it's party, it's, you know, this may sound really weird to people. First, the whole idea of race versus party, that they're different and that they can be disentangled, but that partisan gerrymandering can't be challenged and racial gerrymandering can be. And so much turns on how you're going to characterize what exactly happened. And, you know, those can be hard questions as to whether or not it's race or party, also, even that they're often connected.
Often it seems like they're inextricable. Yeah. But also last Thursday, another federal appeals court issued a ruling that all but ensures North Carolina will use state legislative maps this fall that have been challenged.
They basically, again, decided, following a lower court decision, that they would not block the maps. Those were maps that were adopted by the Republican legislature in the fall, and a Voting Rights Act claim was brought. And I think in some ways what's happened is that they basically decided they wouldn't block it for now. Again, some of these things come up on motions for injunctions. In other words, given that the election is coming soon, the plaintiffs want to stop the new law from taking effect and then hold the trial. And the state is saying, well, no, the law can go into effect. You can have a trial later. Then we can change it later if you find it's unlawful.
And voting rights advocates say that's too late because you can't change the vote.
There is this thing known as the Purcell principle, the idea that you shouldn't be changing the rules governing an election too close to the election. No one knows when is it too close to an election, but we're probably beginning to get there, at least for primaries. Even if some of the earlier action in a case may have taken place months ago. You know, I think in the North Carolina case, there was a decision going back to January of 23. It just took, you know, a long time for it to kind of percolate through the system.
Are states here basically trying to run out the clock?
I think they often do. I mean, they often basically say, well, no preliminary injunction, no emergency motions, please. And then as they continue to bring appeals, that will delay things. There may eventually be a trial, and then there may eventually be an appeal of the trial, and the appeal may actually get decided. And that's kind of what happened in Alabama. But just sometimes they do seem to be stretching it all out in delay and delay and delay.
So these decisions, along with others in recent months, does that mean that the congressional maps for 2024 are largely set?
I think that's right. I think that the litigation is now just about done. We are into April. Many states have already had their primaries. I think there are probably no primaries later than June, or at least not many. I think we're getting very late in the season, and we're probably done.
I want to get your reaction to a political article that said that Republicans came out ahead in the battle to control the House in 2024 thanks to the redistricting aggression of North Carolina Republicans and the timidity of New York Democrats.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that. I may be a little defensive of the New York Democrats. They had a tough situation. But yes, North Carolina did a very sharp gerrymander and basically moved three seats from the Democratic column to the Republican column, which is huge. The problem in New York is that New York does have this independent redistricting commission and this redistricting process that the state adopted in the 2010s, and which was used for the first time in 2022, and the state failed to do it right, according to the New York State's highest court, leading to the appointment of a special master who came up with a plan that was fairly favorable to Republicans. The Democrats got a second shot at this by persuading the Court of Appeals that they had a right to try again, but I think they were kind of gun-shy based on what happened the first time, and they did not want to make an aggressive move to seriously change what was done in 2022. So they tinkered. And my understanding from the more political people is probably at most they might have affected the outcome in one district. Mostly it seems to me that they were kind of protecting Democrats who were in vulnerable districts and may have recalculated one of the districts that which went narrowly Republican last time in a way that makes it even more truly even. But it seems as though it's that based on redistricting, it's not clear there would be any Democratic pickups in New York, or at most one. At one point, Democrats were thinking optimistically there could be three, four, or five. So there was definitely a loss of three seats in North Carolina. Not clear that there was any gain in New York. Alabama was probably a pickup because of the redistricting there. Again, so if we're just talking about maps, I think the remapping was marginally pro-Republican.
Adam Kincaid, the executive director of the National Republican Redistricting Trust, told Politico, it's a marginally more favorable map in 24 than we even had in 22.
That sounds about right. Now, of course, 22 was an election where many people thought the Republicans were going to do really well. And although they did take the House, they took it much more narrowly than had been predicted. Much will turn on, of course, the presidential election. You know, we're still 6 months out from that or more. So no one knows how that's going to go. And turnout is often different in presidential election years than in off years. So the Republicans may be slightly better off now, but the presidential election will matter for a lot. And maybe the kind of the messiness of the Republican Congress will matter for something, too.
It's going to be a long 7 months, that's for sure. Thanks so much, Rich. That's Professor Richard Brefault of Columbia Law School. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.